It is 19 and a half after the hour, it being a Tuesday morning. We're in touch with Dr. Don Clark. Don is a member of the Board of Creation Moments. He's a biochemist by trade. Or is it, that would be your avocate? No, you're a practicing biochemist because you're applying those skills, that knowledge, to the making of wine. So you could still be called legitimately a biochemist, could you not?
Well, I suppose you could say that because I am, I am doing kind of microbiology and stuff with the yeast in order to, ferment grape juice.
Okay.
And then doing chemistry, a lot of chemistry, in order to make a good, great tasting wine.
I'm just thinking, though, because people who are listening to this, and this is radio, they can't see you like David and I can. Picture you standing in a white lab coat behind a counter filled with Bunsen burners and test tubes and flasks of various kinds, colored liquid bubbling up, and maybe steam in the background, And would expect any minute you would say, "It's alive," but no, he's not that kind of biochemist.
Well, yes, when the big yeast start crawling out of the back, of wine, and start taking over the lab.
I can see them oozing out the bottom of the lab door. Yeah.
the giant amoeba.
We and Don speak regularly, just about every Tuesday morning, about matters of science and faith and creation. And this story fits the bill. We've talked many times about how science, say two groups of scientists who don't agree, can work from the same database. In other words, there are machines and sensitive instruments, and there are readings, and there's research that produces data. And then two groups of scientists look at the data and reach different conclusions. This particular article is at New Scientist Daily. And I could put a link in the window, but because you have to subscribe to the site, you wouldn't get the whole article. But it's about a robotic version of a distant ancestor, it says. And it hints about how we learn to walk. Well, what they've done is researched how amphibians and reptiles, who are two different species or two different families, or I'm not sure what the name is for that, but they look similar, but they walk differently, and so they're doing an analysis, and they built a robot, but they keep using words in the description like some reptiles and amphibians look superficially similar, or many reptiles in contrast. Hold, this thing already equivocates in the very first paragraph, Don.
I've seen this in action. Yeah. I've actually watched this take place.
This robot?
What the robot is doing.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they start out as the belly is on the ground and the legs are kind of splayed out to the side. And that's the way Linus has been looking up until this point. Now, Linus is a 6 week old multipoo that Carol is talking about constantly. I think she's forgotten my name, but she's remembered Linus. We're going to go see him.
So Linus's development reflects the whole history of animals, then.
Very much so.
As he progressed from the one cell that he started with to the... he stops at multipoo, though, doesn't he?
Well, he stops at 7 pounds. But,
okay.
But I remember very distinctly, I mean, him laying on the ground, laying on the floor, and his legs are splayed out to all mm-hmm. the sides.
Okay.
And then slowly, he's gathering his legs together and he's pushing up, and I'm on the same page here. I know exactly what's going on.
Don, you've seen the article. What are they trying to prove here?
My
skepticism.
If you read the article, obviously they have a very evolutionary slant, and evolution plays a big role in their hypothesis and in their conclusions before animals or amphibians, of course, the fish, there was fish, and then there was amphibians that lived most of the time in the water and came out a little bit, and then the reptiles that lived completely outside of the water. And this was supposed to be a transitional form between the amphibians living most of the time in the water to the reptiles living outside of the water. And so they were trying to demonstrate that, oh, look, you see here, this must be a transitional animal because it walks upright like a reptile. So the difference between the walking of the amphibian is that its legs are sprawled, you know, horizontally, and it kind of, it does lift up its belly, but not very far off the ground, because it was designed to spend most of the time, you know, in the water. And, you know, some amphibians lay their eggs in the mud, and so they kind of get up out of the water. But a reptile lifts its body up higher, and its legs are more, you know, vertical and upright. And so the belly is lifted higher. So they were trying to see. Now, interestingly enough, they start the first sentence. It says that this creature lived about 290 million years ago. So you know where they're coming from.
Hmm.
But we have a complete, we not only have a very, very much a complete skeleton of this particular creature, the orobates, but we also have footprints in the mud, which has turned to rock. So we have fossilized footprints. And so we know the distance between the footprints and how, you know, how the kind of the stride of the walking. And so the first question one must ask is, well, how can you have a complete, you know, complete skeleton and a complete set of footprints that shows you the walking pattern of this particular animal if indeed all of this is 290 million years ago?
Hmm.
Well, you know, a creationist would look at this and say, well, first, it's not 290 million years ago. It's about 4,000 years since the flood and since the Great Flood. And so this animal was encased in mud and probably alive. And that then created the fossil that we see pictures of in this particular article of a, you know, complete skeleton. And obviously it was running away or walking at the time, or at least some other of its relatives were walking at the time. And so those that got imprinted in the mud at the time of the flood. So, you know, the timing is off. Obviously, the hypothesis is, you know, of course, in my opinion, in many creationists' opinion, the timing is off. And so the conclusions are probably off. And I say probably because if you take a look at the animals today, and I'm kind of reminded when I read this article of, you know, fawn. Let's say you have a deer, and the deer gives birth, and you have a fawn, and what happens shortly after birth, or a horse for that matter, a horse giving birth, how long does that baby horse stay on the ground before it gets upright? It's not long. And it's the same for deer or any animal that needs to be mobile pretty quickly, you know, after birth. And my point being that walking, since they're using walking as a point of trying to connect the amphibians to the reptiles, and this being a transitional form, is already programmed into the DNA. This is, you know, we talk about instincts, and this animal has this instinct, and this animal has these other instincts, and the instincts are there to help, you know, the animal survive. And so, in this case, walking is programmed into the DNA, all the muscles and reflexes that are necessary for that particular process are already there. And have been there from the very beginning. So if you look at it from, you know, a creationist point of view, of course, then there is nothing, you know, nothing different about this particular the orobates in that case, if it does walk upright, and if it did walk upright, then it was designed to walk upright. If it, you know, if it was to, designed to walk, to kind of crawl on its belly like a amphibian, then it was given those properties to help it, you know, suit it to, for it to be suited for its particular environment.
Well, these folks have started the very beginning with the evolutionary assumption. I'll just read a sentence from it. This is about the animal they studied. It's called an orobates. Hope I've said that right. So they have studied an ancient animal called orobates that, in evolutionary terms, there's their bias right there, lies on a branch. There's another bias. They've got a tree that that illustrates one species to another, you know, morphing into another one over time. It lies on a branch between the amphibians and the reptiles. That seems to me like a huge assumption they're making.
Well, it's a very, very huge assumption, because all animals were created with their particular characteristics from the very beginning. Obviously, that's a creationist point of view. But if you ask the question, then how many pre-orobates had to go through in order to get to the orobates, so that its DNA had to change in order for it to walk upright, if indeed that is what they're trying to prove here. And that it seems like at least that research, which they made a robot, a orobates, they kind of recreated the orobates, and they made a robot out of it, and then they program it to walk in various styles, and they find out that the style of the walking that best fits the imprints in the solidified mud is the one where the orobate is walking upright. Okay, that's interesting research in its own. Why do you have to assume that this is a transitional form between the amphibians and the reptiles? You know, those classifications are man's classifications. It has nothing to do with the observable evidence. And so we're trying to make this leap, and we're trying very, very hard to find transitional forms between one animal and another animal. And so we come with these preconceived notions that, if indeed we can prove that this amphibian-ish creature was indeed walking upright, then aha, we've got a transitional form and we have proved evolution. Now, in the article, they don't blatantly say that, but it is completely obvious that that is why they were doing the research in the first place. Instead of saying, did this creature, just answering the question, did this creature walk upright like a reptile, or did it walk flat, kind of flat on its belly like a amphibian.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the video right now, and it's a neat robot. It's a neat toy, but it looks like a robot walking. And actually, it's a pretty nifty invention. But the conclusions they draw from this, the approach the researchers use could throw light on other important evolutionary changes. So again, there's the evolutionary assumption in the way animals move, including the origin of bird flight and the origin of upright walking in hominins, which means we might see robotic versions of other extinct animals soon. Well, we might see other robotic things that look like them, but I think even going from footprints and so forth is less than scientific. I mean, it's kind of wishful thinking, and let's have some fun with this. I'm not sure that this is valid science, Don.
Well, I mean, what they're doing is okay. It's just the conclusions. Mm-hmm. It's the assumptions that they've made from the very beginning and the conclusions that they come up with. Like I said, what was driving this research is a search for a transitional form, and let us explain how, you know, everybody started walking upright, starting with this with the orobates, and then that turning into the reptiles, and then, you know, the reptiles growing hair and losing their tail. trying to get the evolutionary story consistent. What they are forgetting is that, hey, you know, if you looked at the DNA, it's complex from the very beginning. It is not changing over time. Matter of fact, if it's changing, it's as we've talked about before, it's devolving. So the DNA is getting worse instead of better, and we're not adding new information. So information, it takes information to walk from, you know, to walk kind of a flat horizontal type of walk to a more upright walk. That's more information. You got to have the right bone structure. You got to have the right muscles. And of course, you got to communicate to the muscles, to the brain. And all of that is originally programmed in the DNA, like I said. And so to try to stretch this particular experiment, if you will, very expensive one, I have to say, you know, we spend a lot of money on this type of stuff, with hopes of saying, yes, you see, we have proved evolution again. And they have proved nothing. You know, they have, the only thing that they proved is that, okay, maybe the Aurobates did walk more upright like a reptile. And the question that they didn't ask, was it a reptile to begin with? And if it was a reptile to begin with, then they have misclassified the Aurobates, you know, from the very beginning.
Well, it's interesting how science continues to strive, wishful thinking and assumptions to prove evolution, which they've already assumed is true and have based all their logical development on, that the assumption is true, and then come up with proof that it's akin, at least, to circular logic.
Do you suppose that some of the kids in the back, the kids that are doing all the work, the grad students, there's one or two of them that are looking at this experiment and seeing all this wiggly creature moving around on the ground and saying, have you ever heard such nonsense in all your life? I mean, just suppose maybe
not in front of the prof, student. I imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe there's a gifted grad student. I mean, he's never going to say that out loud because, you know, he'd never get out of grad school.
By the way,
for those
of you listening, there is a link to this article in the chat window at brokenroadradio.com, and you can at least see the picture of the robot. It's a subscription kind of service, the New Scientist Daily, so you may not get the entire article with the link, but you'll get the first paragraph and a picture of this thing, because it's kind of interesting. And again, it goes back to supposedly doing research based upon wishful thinking and hoping to prove your basic assumptions. And week after week, we talk about this, and it just goes on and on and on and on. And you might find this interesting to look at. We're talking with Dr. Don Clark, who's a member of the Board of Creation Moments. I want to mention their website to you. It's creationmoments.com. And at Creation Moments, you'll find just a wealth of articles and videos and even blogs on the biblical creation story and the scientific information that supports that story. And that exists, too. You don't often get a look at those things in the world of media these days. But I'd recommend it to you. You can link to it from the Broken Road Radio site. It's over there on the right-hand side. It says Creation Moments. Click on that. It'll take you to their brand-new website. Dr. Don, I want to thank you again for spending time with us and cluing us in. And I guess we should call you the staff debunker. I think that's what...
there you go.
Yep. Yep. You can add that to your business card, debunker. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the other interesting thing about this particular article is how much cranial power did they put into this in order to figure this out?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that's the other thing. I mean, they had to think about this and then obviously spend a lot of money and computer power. And, you know, they got servos and all this to make this animal work. So there's a lot of thought and effort put into the project.
Probably a fun project to do, I imagine, but at somebody's expense.
A lot of fun. I wouldn't have minded working on a project like that.
It takes an engineer, though, not necessarily a, a scientist, a biochemist to do that, or a biologist of any kind.
And at the end of the day, you got this neat toy to play with.
Yeah, you do. And all this publicity. Hey.
Yeah.
Don, thanks very much. Have a terrific week. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
All right. You're welcome. So long.
See you, Don.